history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are some pretty incredible stories out there that need to be told, and we get to hear them each week here as we honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn a heck of a lot. Today we're going to hear some things maybe you haven't thought about before or even considered. Not only are we educated, we're entertained, and always inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. And today I'm in Bakersfield, California with 93-year-old Richard Cruz, originally from East Lansing, Michigan. Growing up there with two brothers, how'd you like all that snow? You get a little bit of white stuff there, don't you?
I remember it well, and I'm very happy to not have to deal with that anymore when I came to California. And that's basically what got me to California.
And we'll have to hear that story. But take us back there. What was life like in East Lansing in the 30s and early 40s?
It was a great place to be a kid growing up with a college there. At the time, it was a college before it became a university. Most of my buddies were family, were involved with the college, so we had access to it. A lot of places we didn't belong, but it seemed like we were always over there doing something. And I became a tremendous sports fan. I enjoyed seeing football, basketball, and a lot of baseball. I tell people I don't recall ever paying for an admission, and all those always had a way to sneak in somehow. And I think a lot of people that knew what I was doing probably turned their head at the time. But it was a great experience, and I value it very much.
Well, I mean, I think of Michigan in the 30s and 40s, and the first thing that comes to my mind are some of those great names playing for the Detroit Tigers at the time. Were you into that at all?
Oh, yeah. Charlie Gehringer, second base. Hank Greenberg, first base. Billy Rogel, shortstop. Marvin Owen, third base. Mickey Cochran and Rudy York at catchers. Goose Goslin, left field. JoJo White, center field. I always remember, or can't remember who the right fielder was. I want to say D. Walker, but they came later, I think. The pitchers, those names were like Schoolboy Rowe, Tommy Bridges, Eldon Auker, Submariner, and I've probably forgotten a few there over the years, but that's best I can do right now.
So were you sneaking into games at that old Tiger Stadium too, or were you listening to those on the radio?
Never. This was all on radio, and the announcer I listened to, most famous Tiger name, Harry Heilman. He was at the tail end of the Ty Cobb era and had batting averages just about equal to Ty Cobb in his day. But my memory of Harry Heilman, in all the years I listened to him, I don't think I ever heard him repeat the same story. He probably did with different names, but I didn't, didn't pick up on that. And he never used a personal pronoun, I. It was always we. It would be if we were playing right field in Chicago one day, and I get into a story, But it was a great experience.
Do you have a specific memory about December 7th, 1941, and how you heard about what happened?
Very vivid. I had just finished mopping my mother's kitchen floor. Swinging door slowly came open. My dad was there. He said, "The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor." My first question was, "Where is Pearl Harbor?" He was able to answer that. I did know where Hawaii was, and from there, my ear was in the radio all that day and the day following, so that was the beginning of it. But it was a shock.
And you had to go to school the next day, I imagine. What was that like?
Well, we were all very much aware. We'd all had that same experience, and I think the teachers probably discussed that to some extent, but they got us back onto our curriculum. Yeah, and all I remember is we were getting information. There was something called a weekly reader. I remember that in high school particularly, and that was published specifically for high school age students, so a lot of that came through. But I also remember every evening, we would be listening to the radio, and even before the war started, you were getting reports from Berlin. You were getting the buildup to this whole thing. And then after the war started, obviously some of the most famous names are Edward R. Murrow, Calton Bourne, and there were others. The radio was on at our house every evening at 7 o'clock. That'd be Lowell Thomas, usually.
Well, when did it start to occur to you that this might be something you, as a young American male, might have to be involved in one way or another?
You know, I don't think I gave it much thought until probably the turn from 42 into 43. And then when I learned that some of my classmates were enlisting, I had this sense that I want to try to control my own destiny. And my first love would have been naval aviation. But they wanted two semesters of college-level work before they would even give you the aptitude test. The Air Force, or Air Corps, actually, was a little bit more open. So they were willing to talk to you as a high school graduate. And so that was the start of that. Took an aptitude test, was accepted, went back, was enlisted, took the oath. And I didn't realize it, but I was in the Army. That was in the aviation cadet program in my mind. But I soon found out I was in the Army.
And you were only 17 at the time?
I turned 18 on June 5th. I think by June 15th, I was in Chicago. All four of us went overnight train.
And when you say all four, you're talking about you and three of your high school friends?
Yeah. And overnight to Chicago, we reported, it was an office building somewhere in downtown Chicago. You were expected, you were on a list, and because you had orders to be there. Anyhow, you were sworn in again, and I still remember being sworn in, and somebody said, "Congratulations, you're now in the United States Army." And that's where it really came home to me. And the next thing you know, you're lined up, you're given a brief physical, you're issued your uniforms. And that was the greatest come down in my life, that this was not the aviation cadet that I thought I was going to be. I was just a private in the United States Army. And from there, it was a troop train to Shepherd Field, Texas. Wichita Falls, Texas. The humidity was not so great, but it was 90 and plus in dusty drill fields and all summer long. And I think got there mid-June, left in mid-August. So it was the worst time you could be in that part of Texas.
And like so many guys who chose to join the Army Air Corps at this time, I don't know if I've met one yet who didn't say that the whole reason he got in the Army Air Corps was he really wanted to be a pilot. You entertain those kind of thoughts?
I basically was thinking that, but I had that navigation desire or interest in the background. From basic training, Shepherd Field, they sent you to college for 4 months. That was in West Virginia. During that period, you were given 10 hours of flight instruction in a Piper Cub. And that's where they figured out if you had natural aptitude for being a pilot. And I think I was very marginal in that area because the last landing I made was perfect. And I taxied and parked the airplane, and I was waiting for this instructor to, you know, get kind of say something nice about it. And the next thing I heard him say, he said, "Well, let's try that again." Well, and then he just broke up laughing. He knew that I could never make that kind of a landing again. But at the end of those 10 hours, I was feeling pretty good about being a pilot. So I was open to the whole thing. I just wanted to succeed at whatever I was going to do.
And that ended up being as a navigator. And I'm sure at the time you're thinking, okay, navigator, I'm going to be with a bomb crew, navigating bomb runs and how to get back after we get shot up or things like that. Bomb runs and how to get back after we get shot up or things like that.
All of those things, yeah. That all went with it. That training was called transition, where you came together as a crew. This was Davis Mountain, Tucson. And that training was to get you ready to fly as a crew, be able to fly formation. Navigator had to find the initial point from there to the target, and the bombardier would actually camera bomb whatever the target was. It was usually a crossroads or a railroad yard or a small town. And I think in the course of that training, we camera bombed virtually every small town in southern New Mexico and parts of Arizona. So, you know, I became acquainted with all of that. So after 2 months of that, basically you were ready to go overseas.
And had you ever even heard of the idea of a weather reconnaissance squadron?
It was all new. We were one of eight crews that after this transition training, we were pulled off and sent to Oklahoma City for further training to join this weather reconnaissance squadron. And we didn't really know until we got there that that's what that was. That group was just finishing their training, the original 12 crews, and we came in behind them to go through similar training and eventually go on and join them as replacements or additional crews, depending on what was needed. The 55th was prepared to go almost anywhere in the world as far as navigation. The plane was capable. It had extra fuel, so we had extra range up to 18 to 20 hours, which is unusual for a B-24. We had crews on Iwo Jima as soon as they could clear them up there after the island was secured. Same thing on Okinawa. So we, as a replacement crew, came in behind those guys, and we started flying missions out of Guam almost immediately. And that had a pattern to it. At the end of the war, it was our turn to be rotated up to Iwo Jima, which we were rotated there. But it was just at the end of the war. We took off on one mission. I think we were out 2 hours. We got a message that said, just return to Iwo. They didn't want us flying up over Japan by ourselves. It was that touchy period after the war, after the bombs had gone down, but after the Japanese had agreed to surrender as to who's in control in Japan. And I think we were, the higher ups were just getting things under control, and probably the last thing they wanted was a lone B-24 flying up there on its own with nobody else knowing why it was there and that kind of thing. So I think that's why we were called back.
Well, and you mentioned the increased range, which would have been unusual for a B-24. So what were the changes, the modifications? How were those B-24s you were flying different from those configured for bombing?
They were classified as a B-24L. They put two 250-gallon fuel tanks in the forward bomb bay. It's 500 additional gallons. Then the rear bomb bay was enclosed, and that took an airborne radar, and that was all completely carpeted for take the sound out as much as possible. So that radar basically was to look at weather as we encountered it, try to get some idea of the severity of it, the height of the clouds, that sort of thing. The meteorologist and myself were in the nose. My instruments and everything were up there, a drift meter and all of my navigation equipment, and the weather guy had his instruments that he read. So I needed a position report every 20 minutes. He had his dad every 20 minutes. We claimed we were the only two guys on the airplane that were working or even awake sometimes. We would jot all this down on a piece of paper, pass it back to the pilots. They would pass it to the radio man, and he would send it someplace, we don't know. It was somewhere in the headquarters of the 20th Air Force where they were, you know, collecting this weather data and tracking it day by day by day. Our real job was to find typhoons as they developed and be able to track them from there just so people could get out of the way. So that was our main assignment.
In fact, your squadron carries that moniker, the original Typhoon Hunters.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, I asked you about the modifications to those B-24s, but what about the crew? I mean, if you're not carrying bombs, I guess you have no need for a bombardier, right?
No. Dropped our bombardier, took on a weatherman and a radar operator who'd been trained as a bombardier. So there were five officers and five enlisted men.
And we'll learn about how their weather reconnaissance missions worked when we come back. What does it feel like inside a B-24 when you fly into the center of a typhoon? Richard Cruz will help us understand when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.